All right, so we're gonna get started. It's interesting. Usually in the past, I've just been inundated with interviews. But in the past, on Sunday nights, I was doing a series of introductions, which I'm gonna get back to. Before I get to Diana Ostrov asking me to give the shiur, there's a Hakdama written by the Ramah. Ramah of Ramosha Isserles, who wrote commentary obviously on the Shulchan Aruch, who actually wrote an introduction to Megillas Esther, right? And the reason why he did it is that in his time there was a cholera outbreak, and he was so dejected by the fact that people weren't able to celebrate Purim together and have like a big simcha that he decided to write a parish on Megillas Esther. So it's not a very chunky introduction. Which is interesting, what they called it. If it were a longer one, it would have been something to discuss. But anyway, however, what they called it. Instead, we'll talk about Esther. And I think Esther, as you'll see when we start going through the topic, Esther always presents to me personally a very challenging figure, because and it in other words, what I should say is like this. There's the unique aspect of Esther, and then there's the general phenomenon, which we see in many of the major personalities in Tanakh, where Chazal struggle to basically close the gap between how the person's presented in the source and what Chazal, so to speak, I'm saying is carefully want them to be. That doesn't mean they weren't like that, but as you'll see as we go through it, there's like this almost disconnect sometimes that you see between what the Megillah says and what Chazal talk about Esther being. But then I'll show us a part at the end of the story that I think really helps bring to light a unique aspect of Esther's personality, which made her to be very, very successful. Also, I know it's very popular today when you speak about Megillas Esther to put in the context of political intrigue. And there's many books written about how Esther really models Western political environment. It could be. I'm just trying to listen to. Trying to remove as much 21st century bias as possible and just try and see Esther for how the Megillah presents her. So that's what we're going to take up. And as I mentioned before, I was asked to give this year by Diana, and it's to commemorate the yahrzeit of her aunts, and obviously her name being Esther Bas Eliyahu. Thus why we're going to be speaking about Esther as this unique role model. Okay, so let's begin with Esther's name. All right. Our first introduction to Esther comes with this obviously very famous verse where it says, Vahi Omenes Hadassah, after we meet Mordechai, we find out that he's raising Esther. But the Megillah says, who is this person? Vahi Omenes Hadassah, he Esther Bastodo, Kien lo Avaim. Right. So Esther's orphaned. And I'm not going to get into whether they were married or not. That's a separate thing. Let's just make it simple. Mordechai takes in this orphan and raises her. Okay, her name now is the confusing part. She's Hadassah, right? And also Esther, which is going to be the focal point of the Gemara. But she's both. Okay. Now, what's odd, obviously, is that the name Hadassah never appears again in the Megillah. She's only known as Hadassah once and one time only here. There's no other point in time you'll ever see the name Hadassah. So now we know she's orphaned. And then in a classic description, the Hanara Yafas Torah Tavas Mare. Okay. So she was beautiful. And some point out that it's like a double beauty because Vashti is only Tovas Mare. She's one level, pleasant to look at. Esther was stunning. So what we see from this pasuk is we don't really see much about her personality. We see that she had this double name, all right, almost the equivalent to today, right? There's the Jewish name, like for instance. My English name is Daryl and my Hebrew name is Devere. Sounds like Hadassah and Esther is the same thing. And it's probably much easier to get by in Persian society with a name like Esther than with a name like Hadassah. She's orphaned, right? And she's beautiful. We don't really know much else about Esther. And of course, we went on the story. What happens to her? She gets entered into this contest. So we know she's only referred to Hadassah here. She's an orphan and she's beautiful. Okay, so this is going to present some unique challenges for Chazal. I mean, Chazal really go out of their way to always try, well, I should say always, but often to try and sort of like bridge the gap Because if all we see this about Esther, so it sounds like she's really, really beautiful. And that's about it. What other features, and I'm not saying beauty's bad, but what other features does she have going for her? Now, of course, Chazal are going to use the story, right, and work backwards. They're going to use the events of the story to now explain why it had to be Esther was a certain kind of person. But when we see how Chazal decide to describe Esther, it's very, very interesting, their perspective, okay? Now, before we get to the Gemara, okay, if we looked at the simple pshat, in a very simple way of reading the Megillah, what we probably would say is that since Hadassah is really, if you think about it, the only, so to speak, Jewish name to appear in the Megillah. Mordechai is not really a Jewish name. There are no Jewish names in the Megillah. The names are Persian. Achashverosh is not a Jewish name. Obviously, Haman is not a Jewish name. You don't have your classic Reuven, Shimon, Levi type names appearing in the Megillah at all. So the only time you have any sense of a classical Jewish name would be Hadassah. That was a name. So it is interesting that it's like the author is trying to let us know that even though Jews in that period of time were assimilated, which again, we also know that from the various drushas, as well as the way the story goes, it sounds like the Jewish people, certainly in Shushan, were fairly assimilated. If you ever read about, I mean, we know this from the time of Ezra, which is not that far after, that the Jews were so assimilated that when they came back to Israel, most of them were married to non-Jews. So we see that there was a lot of assimilation, but it could be the author's trying to tell us, before we get to the Gemara, that with all the assimilation, with all the fact that Esther was really part of secular society, there was some, so to speak, Jewishness to be found in her. And that's going to be one of our goals. One of our goals, and I think today or tonight, is going to be how to really root out and focus on what makes Esther Jewish and our classic Jewish ideals. So what does Chazal say about Esther? All right, so there's a debate, as there always is a debate in the Gemara. The debate is that who was she? Was she Hadassah but called Esther, or was she Esther but called Hadassah? Now let's think about that for a second. It would seem on the surface, right, that there's really two ways you could look at this person, right? Again, we're talking about someone raised in a extremely secular society. Jews were fairly assimilated. So the question becomes, right, was she someone that really was, her core were Jewish values, like she was a Jew at heart, and she was able to, what it called, thrive in a secular world, right, which is one possibility. Or it could be that really she was kind of raised as in a non-Jewish way, meaning I'm not saying Mordechai didn't raise her to be Jewish, but basically she was someone who in this society was really, so to speak, didn't know much about Judaism or didn't really have that core Jewish, religious Jewish values, but she exhibited Jewish values. You have that sometimes. You can have people who, even though they're not raised in a Jewish house, that doesn't mean, or in a Jewish society, that doesn't mean they don't have certain values that really are in line with Jewish values. And I'll give you an example not to offend anybody, Lahavdil Alfei Alafos, but I remember when I was in dental school, I went to dental school with a lot of Mormons. And I always found fascinating that Mormons have a tremendous, very, very good morals. I'm not getting into their philosophy or into their desire to convert Jews to their side or in their belief that, you know, Jews are condemned to whatever, just as simply as being moral people. They don't steal, they don't curse. They're just like very good people. So you don't necessarily have to be raised in a Jewish house to exhibit what we would call Jewish values. But this tension here between whether she's Hadassah slash Esther, Esther slash Hadassah, really could be something along the lines of, you know, what was she at her core? Was she really someone who wasn't like, so to speak, the firmest person, but she happened to naturally exhibit Jewish values? Or was she really that firm person inside and she was able to thrive even in the secular world? And I think the various interpretations Chazal are about to give really echo this this sentiment. So let's say her name was actually Esther. So if it was Esther, why is she called Hadassah, right? Why is it important for us to know that she was called Hadassah? So this is almost like low-hanging fruit from Chazal, okay? This is Chazal saying, why was she called Hadassah? Because she's a tzaddik, right? Tzaddikim are called, it comes from the idea of a hadas. Tzaddikim are known, she has to be some type of tzaddik or tzaddikas. That's like an important thing, right? Now, again, why is that important for Chazal to say this? Because if they don't say this, right, if they don't give her that shame of being a tzaddikas, then they have a serious problem because nowhere in the Megillah, yes, she does save the Jewish people. No one disputes that. But the road to get there isn't exactly a pretty road. She's entered into this contest that certainly is not the ideal place for a Jewish woman to be involved in. she gets married to Ahasuerus, which raises all sorts of tremendous halakhic problems. There's a blot in Sanhedrin dedicated to just understanding how this marriage could possibly take place. You have to play. There's a lot of gymnastics, intellectual gymnastics that you need to go through to try to really get understand how she could really be this tzaddikah. So Chazal are concerned. They don't want us to see Esther in the simple way. They want us to believe, going into the story, that yes, she has like all those qualities, even though she's not going to, on the surface, she doesn't exhibit them. You should know that ultimately she is a righteous person. She has the qualities of being a tzaddikah, even though the story doesn't really reflect that, as we'll see as we get into it. Okay. So that's going to be our serious question. How exactly was she righteous? Okay. Is it simply the fact that she, I shouldn't oversimplify it, but is it that her desire to save the Jewish people? Okay. But you can argue that anytime someone is motivated to save a minority, right, from genocide, are they by definition righteous? Is that what the Gemara is like hinting at? So we'll have to explore that a little bit, what it means that she was actually righteous. Now, let's say she was Hadassah, which means she had that Jewish core. Fine. So why is she called Esther? Okay, why Esther? So the Gemara gives a couple interpretations, actually several. So one of them is that she was great at hiding who she was, right? As we all know, after when Esther is entered into the contest, so Mordechai advises her, right, not to reveal her identity. And there's a huge debate among commentaries as to why it was so important for her to hide her identity. It's not as simple as saying to prevent anti-Semitism. There's a lot of other reasons why. Some of the reasons actually reflect Mordechai's political acumen. But overall, the idea was that she was really great at hiding who she was. Now, let's not minimize that. If you think about it, and we can certainly go back to recent history from things like from the Holocaust, the idea of being able to hide well who you really are is not a simple thing to do. The trait of having the psychological energy to really make sure that no one knows who you are is a very, very strong capability, but it is a method of deceiving, right? I mean, you're deceiving somebody. You know, we know there's a value in Torah of always being honest. Not always, but more often not being honest, of your inside and your outside being the same. And it's interesting that it's almost like a complimentary thing that she was great at deceiving. I mean, again, she's lying about who she is. Now, again, of course, you could say there's a greater good involved, but still, this is one of Esther's most remarkable traits. She was an incredible liar, top of the line. As we see throughout the story, she is so good at manipulating. And in many ways, as you'll soon see, manipulating and lying go hand in hand. She was almost like a natural at being able to do it. And think of Rivka, okay? Rivka really, okay, if you look at the story of Rivka, Rivka was raised in a house, right, where trickery and being and deceiving were, what it called, were normal, right? It was a very normal, raised with Laban, I should say, but it was a very normal way of what it called, of seeing things, that the idea of deceiving and manipulating were really basically part of the values of that house. And of course, it's almost wishful thinking to say that, well, Rivka, you know, she wasn't affected by it. I don't think that's true. I think she was. Now, did she divert that for the good? Yes. But we know that she hid information from Yitzchak, right? And she was involved in making sure that Yitzchak was, to some degree, manipulated by Yaakov. So we see there's almost a precedent for someone like Esther, Rivka. Rivka really personifies this idea of being able to deceive and manipulate. I'm not trying to produce a negative connotation, but that's what they're doing. So this sheet in the Gemara is saying why she called Esther. She had this trait of being able to deceive others, right? But again, when we categorize it for the sake of saving the Jewish nation, I'd say it makes us definitely feel more comfortable about it. But at the end of the day, there's no question that in general, the idea of deceiving, right, is certainly a trait that is contradictory to Jewish values. That is not something that if you look in Pirkei Avos, or in any Sefer Musar, you're going to see as a value. And yet, we see Esther was so good at it. Now, the other interpretations, okay, focus on another aspect that I know we find often among some of the matriarchs, the idea of beauty, okay? And certainly in the 21st century, it's very hard to understand why such value is placed on beauty. There's no denying that Chazal learned that there are three reasons they give about Esther. Under the Hadassah, all have to do with her beauty, okay? And for instance, the first one is she's called after Istahar, which has to do with this beauty of the moon. meaning she was known far and wide around the world, so to speak, for her beauty. The second shot is her beauty was that she was neither too tall or too short. And the third one was is that she was green. And I know everybody knows that that's famous medrash that she was green, but it says she had a thread of chesed around her. But these all point towards physical aspects of her. The perushim before really were dealing with things like inner traits, things like, again, controlling her ability to manipulate and not to deceive others, or these traits of righteousness that we don't even know that she has. This is focusing purely on the externals. Now, of course, we could say that this is going to be critical for the success of the story. We need to be honest. The fact is that Esther would not have become the queen if it weren't for the fact that she was beautiful. She was the right person at the right time. A lot of the reason why was because of her beauty. And again, we have to ask ourselves, first of all, this wasn't something that Esther was able to do. She was born with it, right? Notice, we don't know really, the Megillah tells us nothing about her lineage. We know that she's raised by Mordecai. We don't know anything about her parents. We don't know what she's genetically predisposed for. The fact that she was beautiful, it's out of her control. It's not a trait. It's simply something that she happened to be born with. But they emphasize that it's an important thing. And as we know, it was very important for her to be successful in this story. But of course, the question is, why do we need these different, these different interpretations, okay? Why is it so important for us to know this? So again, as I mentioned a second ago, the objective beauty idea, the idea of her being Istahar, is important for the upcoming mission. If she is a beautiful person, she will be the right person to save the Jewish people. And that is really what Chazal want us to focus on. Again, they don't want us to focus on beauty just for the sake of beauty itself. It's that there was an overall long-term, you got to play the long game here, a long-term objective that the beauty was going to fulfill. And then the second two opinions, in many ways, if you think about it, are kind of modifying the first, okay? I want to say that the idea of her being neither too short or too tall, I think that in beauty, sometimes there's a certain effect that beauty can have on somebody. And not to get too much into art, but if you ever go and see like a beautiful painting of a person, sometimes the beauty of the person, there's a certain appreciation a person has, a certain effect that the image has on the person. It's not necessarily sexual. It could be something simply appreciating something beautiful as itself. So in number two, I think it could be that her beauty was one that didn't stand out too much. It was just like this natural beauty. But the third shot, I think, emphasizes this idea of being green. I don't think it means that she was sickly, because it'd be hard to imagine that Ahasuerus would want to marry someone who was sickly looking. Rather, it could be that she was exotic. We see this shot by the term Cushi. In the Torah, when Tzipora is described, and there's other places in Nachla this comes up, the Radak explains that that actually refers to a type of an exotic beauty, someone who looks different than everyone else, right? But that difference itself is a type of beauty. And again, that idea of that chut shel chesed could be is that even though she looked different from everyone else, which often, especially in a xenophobic society, makes people uncomfortable, somehow she was able to go ahead and still produce a positive reaction in people. So in my opinion, I think that the Gemara is focused on is that, yes, she was beautiful, and that's important for what she's going to be going through. But at the same time, that beauty also was not something that really had a negative effect on people. Rather, it made people feel good. That's going to be very important in a very subtle way, but very important for when Esther confronts Ahasuerus. Remember, which we're going to get to soon, when Esther decides that the right approach to take is going to be to approach Ahasuerus, it's critical that when Ahasuerus sees her, remember, you can't just go up to the king. This aspect of her beauty, not just looking beautiful per se, but the fact that she had a certain comforting, positive effect on people, was going to be very important for her to be successful when she was going to go ahead and approach Ahasuerus. So at this point, what was great about Esther, right? If we stop right now, what's so great about Esther? Well, you could argue she has Jewish traits in a secular world, okay, which can be challenging, okay? She's an expert in deception, right? That's for sure. Strong control of her psyche. And she's beautiful, which is important to win the contest and for future, issues with Ahasuerus. These are really the three dominant things we see in the Megillah, right? You could also argue, I mean, I'm not denying courage. There's a lot of courage required. We don't see this until later on. A lot of courage required in stepping up and going to going to Ahasuerus, selflessness. There's no question she had that. Those are definitely Jewish traits, but that's not the dominant part of how she's described. It's her beauty that's the focus, right? And the constant manipulation and deceiving. As we all know, the plan to the parties and everything like that was clearly, I mean, I often tell people that of all the Svarim written in Tanakh, I would argue that Esther is the one written in a way where you don't really need any Mefarshim. It's like the one safer where if no one wrote a Parish, I don't think we'd be losing that much. I'm not denigrating anyone who gives a Parish on Esther, but because the story is so obvious. I mean, it's so clear how Esther's manipulating Ahasuerus's ego. So these are the main things you see about Esther. Okay. Again, she has some Jewish traits. Well, let's say selflessness and courage. We don't see it all the time, but in certain instances, but certainly expert in deception and beauty are the main things that we know about Esther at this point in time. Okay. So let's see Esther in action. And that's what I'm going to spend the next, basically the second half of this on, which is the what Esther decides, how Esther acts in certain situations. Okay. So let's talk about first when Esther confronts Ahasuerus. So again, to picture the scene, as the Megillah tells us what happens, it's always a good, the third day of the fast. Esther puts on these clothing. Okay. It's interesting that it doesn't have the word big day, but that's a separate question. Batilbash Esther Machos, we'll learn it simply. She puts on her queen clothing. Batamod Bachatzar Besamelech Hapnimis Nochak Besamelech, right? So she's standing in the chatzar, basically in the inner chamber, okay, before Ahasuerus's room is. And Ahasuerus is sitting inside. So what's important here is that Esther's walking through one room before she gets to the room that Ahasuerus is in, okay? And when, of course, as we know, when Ahasuerus sees Esther, Nosachim Beinov, he's okay with it, so to speak, and he sticks out the Sharvit, and she's able to come, and the story proceeds from there. So the Gemara has this very odd, very, very strange idea that it brings up about Esther here, which is that Esther, that room that she passed through, right, on her way to see the king, was actually a room filled with idols, okay? Okay, all right. But the Gemara says that at that point in time, because she was in that room, the divine presence left her, which is a shocking statement. I mean, this is Esther who's going into the king, putting her life on the line, carrying the Jewish nation on her shoulders, so to speak, and she has to go through this room. And yet, what does the Gemara say? That she lost her connection to God at that point, which seems harsh, if anything. So Esther asks God, right, is it because I called him a dog, right? And that refers to different metrics, but the point is that Esther at some point referred to Ahasuerus as a dog, and she says, if that's the case, then I will go ahead and call him a lion, all right? And then by calling him a lion, so now she's able to re-engage the divine presence and move from there. This is a very bizarre, in my opinion, a very strange Gemara. What does it mean that this, what's this room of idols? What does it mean that she lost the Hashgacha? And what's this idea that she first called him a dog and then she says she's going to call him a lion? Why does that solve whatever the problem was? Why does this solve the problem? So I think the answer is like this, okay? I think that of all the acting that Esther had ever done, right? And she's being groomed to be a phenomenal actress. This is a person who, during the contest, was able to hide her identity to a T. Let's assume she was normally from. I mean, the Gemara indicates that, you know, she kept Shabbos and she was eating kosher, all these things she was able to do without anyone knowing about it, which is tremendous, right? So here it is, she's going to put on the greatest acting performance possible, all right? So why is the room of idols important? What does the room of idols represent? Okay, I don't think it means that there's a room filled with idols per se. I think it means that the Gemara, or at least Chazal, trying to frame for us, okay, that there was more than just, it was more than just her life being on the line. There's no question she was putting her life on the line for the Jewish people, right? But what about the fact that she was about to engage in an extremely manipulative type of behavior? She knew what she was about to do. She was about to take this human being, Ahasuerus, and yes, he wasn't a great guy for sure, right? But remember, Ahasuerus, Chazal paint him as a terrible Russia. He's no real friend of the Jews, but he's not Haman, right? She's going to go in there and basically completely tug at his strings, make him feel insecure, play up to his ego, etc., putting into effect this entire mischievous plan, okay? So engaging this type of behavior is something dangerous, right? It's a very dangerous thing for a person to do. And I think what Chazal is saying is that as she's approaching Ahasuerus, there's a certain recognition that what she's about to do is not necessarily the greatest behavior for a person to engage in. It's dangerous, right? To really manipulate someone's personality is not something that we would say is, even for a great cause, the action itself is still something that could be very damaging to a person's psyche. Think about the power someone has over, the power you wield over someone else when you try and manipulate them. It's a very, very, it's certainly ego gratifying. It can really have a very negative effect on the person. Okay. So what's the dog lion issue? So what she realized, all right, is that in order to succeed, she had to separate the following. Okay. She had to separate the Ahasuerus person, hedonistic, misogynistic, egocentric, the insecure human that he was, from the fact that he's powerful, a ruler, a lawgiver, and authority. Think about how challenging that is, all right? And I'm going to bring up a person in a second who I think personifies that, but think about that challenge. You're here to, again, you have this important mission. You're trying to save your people, okay? And you have to face this human being who you feel is clearly someone who goes so much against values. I mean, that's why you're manipulating him. I mean, again, it's clear he's hedonistic, right? It's not even a question, egocentric. And yet, but at the same time, you have to recognize, and this is the lion part, he's the ruler of the world at that point. He is the person who makes laws for the kingdom. So she had to, in order for her to succeed, she had to push aside, she had to split Ahasuerus into two and kind of push aside the human Ahasuerus and simply look at the king Ahasuerus. That was going to be the key to her success. And if you think this is such an easy thing to do, and I'm not here to offend anybody, but let's look at our, what do you call it, our ex-president, okay? I'm not trying to weigh into politics here, and I know I'm going to get into trouble for this, but think about this. Think about meeting with ex-president Trump to discuss support for Israel, okay? Now, I know that that on the one hand, there's this tremendous desire to want what's best for Israel. But President Trump, again, let's just focus on Trump himself, right? The fact is that many of those characteristics of Ahasuerus that was described by Ahasuerus, there's not even a question Trump has those same traits. I mean, this is not a person who in any way, shape, or form reflects any normative sense of morality, okay? Misogynistic, egocentric, insecure. You don't need to be an expert, a therapist to understand that about Trump. So he may disgust you as a human, but at the same time, what about the fact that he's the president or was the president of the United States of America, the most powerful ruler in the world, someone who there's a certain respect that comes with that type of position. So imagine the challenge. I don't think everyone listening to this would be at that challenge. Some people would be like, no big deal. But I don't know. I would see it difficult to separate the two because it's very hard sometimes to see that on the one end, this person has traits that are so nauseating. On the other hand, this person, because of their position of power, there's a certain respect you must have for them. So in order for Esther had to overcome that resistance, that idea of looking at him in this denigrating way, he's not a dog. Look, if you look at him as a lion, if you see him for the king that he is, then she'll be able to succeed. And that was really helped her out when it came to her ability to, initiate the plan. And that leads us to the main part. Well, there's, to me, that's one aspect of an analysis, of an insight into what was required for Esther to be successful in manipulating Ahasuerus. But I really think that, this is not analyzed often, surprisingly so, I think this second request that Esther makes, to me, really brings out the actress, the phenomenal actress that Esther was. And I'm not saying she was faking it. I'm just saying she was just so incredible at displaying the right emotions at the right time to get what she needed done. And that's really the second request, okay? The first request, so to speak, is the parties, okay? Once the parties take place, right? So now she sets this whole scene up and eventually, right? She accuses Haman. And then after accusing Haman, what happens? Ahasuerus, acts accordingly, he gets killed, right? She was brilliant at that. But the story doesn't end there, right? And it's funny, like everyone, I've been laning Megillah for, 20 years now. So there's a certain, after you lane Mihu Zev Ezehu, and then the parak ends with, parak Zion ends with Haman being hung on the tree that was saved by Mordechai. It's almost like the main part of the story is over. But in truth, it's not, because just because Haman was killed, the entire Jewish nation is still in danger because Ahasuerus already sent out an edict to kill all the, or to say that it was free reign to kill the Jews, right? So that being the case, just because Esther took down Haman, that's great, right? But there was still the rest of the Jewish nation that she had to save. Now, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing the change that takes place in Esther's personality, okay? So what happens? Esther takes down Haman. Mordechai is promoted to take over Beit Haman. So Mordechai becomes the chief advisor to Ahasuerus. And Esther undergoes this remarkable change, okay? During phase one, she was confident, she was bold, she was able to manipulate. I mean, look at the way she acted. I mean, it was literally, she was like playing chess with people. able to get the party this and to say the right things to Achashverosh. I mean, she was so good at really setting the whole board up for what ended up happening. And you needed to be that confident, bold, manipulative type of person to pull off what she did. What happened in phase two? Okay, this second request. Completely different kind of Esther, okay? How does Megillah describe it? That toast up Esther, now she speaks it for him. What happens now? She falls down on her knees before, what do you call it, before the king, right? She cries, right? Esther's not that crying person that we see beforehand, but now she's crying. She's supplicating, right? Batiskana, she's supplicating him what to do what? To remove Lahaviris Ra'as Haman Agagi, right? To basically get rid of it, right? Because what does she realize, right? And this is where, again, what does Achashverosh do? He gives a Sharvit. Esther stands up and now stands before the king. Remember, in the first time in Parakeh, she wasn't begging, right? She wasn't on her hands and knees. She wasn't crying. Here, it's a whole different woman, okay? And what does she say? She says, Imal Malach Tov, V'imatzasi Chen Lefanav, V'chasher Devatim Melech, V'tovan Yimenav. Look at all this she says. I mean, it's a huge statement. She's saying, if it's good for the king, if I found favor before him, if it's okay for the king, if I'm good before him, it's like she's a completely different person now. What does she want? For him to reverse the edict, okay? To reverse the edict that he put out, to erase it, okay? And then she says, and for those who lane it, they know that the common practice is to lane this in Echatun to really convey what she's trying to say, because how could it be? How could it be that Esther, how could it be that her people are dying? How could she live to such a thing? It would be tragic for her to witness such a thing, okay? So I'm not saying she's not being genuine here. What I am saying, though, is there's a little bit of acting taking place, as we'll see in a second. She's obviously concerned about the Jewish people, but the fact that she supplicates herself this way in front of Achashverosh, she's, again, also a more subtle type of manipulation is taking place there. And I'll show you why in a second from the way the Pesukim play out, okay? So what does the king respond? What's the king's response to what Esther asks, okay? It's funny. He says, Vayemer melech Achashverosh l'Esther malchah ulu Mordechai ha-Yudi. Notice now, Mordechai's back in the picture, okay? Before, Esther goes to Achashverosh. Achashverosh gives the Shravit. Esther falls on her hands and knees, begs Achashverosh. Now, he calls in, so to speak, Mordechai as well, okay? This is going to be very important. And he says, he neves Haman, right? Nasati l'Esther. So I gave the house of Haman to Esther. We hung him, right? Now, what's the plan? Vatem kislo ayudim katom enechem shem melech. Go ahead and write whatever you want in the name of the king, right? Okay, so he has like this plan, and we're going to get to in a second what happened. But here's what happens here: Esther turns herself right into a weepy shell of her former self. She employs some serious guilt. I mean, think about the guilt she's laying on Achashverosh. Right? How could this happen? How can you please don't let this happen to my people? It's impossible for me to live in such a way. This is guilting Achashverosh. Okay. She also, and this is critical, she makes a request of Achashverosh that she knows it is impossible for Achashverosh to ever do. And that is to reverse his edict. I mean, she says openly, Lahaviris Rasamagi, to rip up, to get rid of the edict. But she knows that's impossible because, and the Malbim actually, it's not just my insight, the Malbim actually says that, but everyone knew that. Everyone knew that, I mean, we saw from the beginning of the story, which we'll get to in a second, the king can never make an edict that, once he makes an edict, that's it, you can't go back on it. So the question then is that, when Achashverosh responds the way he does, was she anticipating this response? So I'd say like this, if we go back to the beginning of the story, okay, what happens? So the king summons Vashti, and Vashti refuses to come, okay? And, oh, I misspelled that, I apologize. He's not filled with rag, but filled with rage. The king, Achashverosh, is very angry, and then the Megillah says his anger burned in him, okay? Now, what does he do? And this is a real easy insight to Achashverosh's personality. He summons his advisors, unsure of how to proceed. That's classic Achashverosh, okay? And you know, again, I just only because of I like American political history, but what do you call it? But we see that that's a common thing where you have a president and a cabinet and a chief of staff and national security advisor. You surround yourself with people who you can go to. But Achashverosh is a little bit different because Achashverosh, he's not going to his advisors because he, what do you call it? Like he has an idea and wants to run a buy-in. Rather, he goes to his advisors because he doesn't know how to proceed. Right, Achashverosh is trapped. And one thing about his personality is that he doesn't deal well with conflict, okay? So on the one hand, the affront to his ego by Vashti was huge, right? I mean, this is unbelievable. She refused to come in. He could not take such a thing. But he's got a problem, though. Vashti, as certainly the common way the Megillah story is told by Chazal, is that Vashti was the real power. That Ahasuerus married her, so to speak. He didn't come from any royalty. She was the royalty, right? So since she was the real power, he couldn't just impulsively kill her, because if he impulsively kills her, people are going to say that they won't love him. They won't look at him as a legitimate ruler. They would think this is all part of a plan. So Ahasuerus is trapped. Ahasuerus hates being trapped. He hates being in a situation where he doesn't know what to do. Okay, he's trapped here. So what does he do? So what happens? Memuchan steps off and offers what would be considered to be an ingenious solution. He says, repackage, and this is very 21st century, but repackage the issue from being a domestic dispute, meaning one between man and wife, this man and wife, to a sociological epidemic. The reality is that we can't allow the women to refuse things that their men ask of them. How could such a thing be tolerated? That really, that Ahasuerus is representing a movement, right? He's representing a movement that is the correct way that marriages should take place. That is incredible by Memuchan's sake, because by making it into a national crisis, I mean, you can see echoes of how politicians operate today. Politicians are notorious for taking minor things and making them into these massive, national crises. And Memuchan, without question, exhibited these types of political instincts to the point where, as Winston Churchill famously said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Memuchan saw this opportunity. He saw this. That's why I don't care if he was Haman or not. The point is, you want a guy like Memuchan on your staff, because this guy really understands politics well. But what he did is he solves a problem for Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus was looking for some type of solution, right? That would in essence, get rid of the conflict he had. And Memuchan really gives him that opportunity. But that's classic Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is always, always dependent on his advisors to move forward. There's another great example, okay, before we get into this part. At the time where Ahasuerus comes, or what happens when Ahasuerus is faced with the accusation by Esther? So Esther now, imagine the scene. He's in his room, or he's got the guards on the outside, okay? We'll get back to him in a second. And he looks at Esther, his wife, and Haman, his trusted advisor. And now he sees this conflict. On the one end, he has his wife, who he seems to really, in his way, love, right? Who he trusts, telling him that his most trusted advisor, right, is horrible, right? Imagine for someone like Ahasuerus, the conflict that presented. But what's fascinating is, what does he do, right? In classic Ahasuerus fashion, right, he runs away, right? He couldn't be in the room anymore. He couldn't handle the conflict. It's an amazing thing. And it's perfect for someone like him, because what would he normally do is he turned to his advisor. But when his advisor is the person that's being accused of turning on him, he runs outside. He has no choice, right? He can't take it. And even when he comes back inside and sees the scene, so to speak, where it's clear, you know, that again, Haman tripped, however he tripped is important. No fell on Mita, right? It looks like he's making a pass at Esther. And what do you call it? Gav Lichbosh, right? Ahasuerus gets angry. It's still up to Harvona, right, to say ultimately kill him. Meaning he still needed an advisor to push him for that final stage. Okay. So here, right, when we get back to phase two, okay, the king was justified in killing Haman. There's no reason why he shouldn't have. Haman was a threat. Okay, but look how fast Ahasuerus moves. The Megillah points out that the same day that he kills Haman, he promotes Mordechai. Not one day could go by in Ahasuerus' life, we didn't have that key advisor next to him. He always needed that advisor. So he promotes Mordechai, okay? No remnant of Haman could remain at all, because if any reminder of Haman would always mean that Ahasuerus was a failure about something, okay? And now, once again, we're right back to where we were at the beginning of the Megillah. The king had acted impulsively, right? And now he's creating a whole new problem. There's a whole new problem now that needs to escape from, which is very simple. He killed Haman, but here's the problem. On the one hand, his wife's people, right, and Mordechai's people happen to be the Jews, right? That's bad. On the other hand, he can never go and reverse his own edict. So what does he do, okay? So in solving his personal problem, he now created this tremendously challenging inconsistency. Again, how could Mordechai be his top advisor and Esther be his queen if his edict demanded the killing of their people? But at the same time, what's he supposed to do? So this is where I think Esther also is starting to manipulate, a little more subtle, but starting to manipulate Ahasuerus, the crying, the guilt. She's pushing Ahasuerus to a certain position, okay? So what does she do? So first she says, she made sure the king did not feel, she made sure that Ahasuerus never felt culpable for what happened. It was very important that Ahasuerus hear from Esther that she didn't blame him at all. So, and because remember, we know that Ahasuerus and Haman made a deal. She says to put away the evil that Haman did, right? That means that Ahasuerus was not really part of the plan at all. So imagine the feeling Ahasuerus must have had when it kind of, when he sensed that, well, she doesn't blame me at all for anything. Okay. But then on top of that comes the guilt, the crying, all this is guilt. But now you got a problem. Esther, I think, realized, okay, and again, this is the part of her that's necessary to be successful in the story, but it is manipulating, is that she realized it would never be enough, okay? The king cannot go back on his word. Rather, Ahasuerus had to be pushed on his own to finally come up with his own plan, all right? In all the cases before, right, Ahasuerus is always nudged forward. It's always someone external to him, right, clearly telling him, do this. What she did was in a more subtle way. And again, she is the external, but he doesn't know that. She's pushing him to finally become the independent king he needed to be. And that is to come up with a plan on his own for him to make the statement of what needed to be done. Okay. So that's why, right. And again, going back to Rivka acts in a very similar way with Yitzchak. Okay. After the truth of Esav comes out, it's an amazing thing what happens in the story and told us. Okay. Yitzchak finds out. And it's almost like the way I describe it is Yitzchak becomes catatonic. It's like he's frozen because basically, if you think about it, what happened? He thought for sure, right? I'm not going to get into all the different reforshim. The simple shot is he thought for sure this was one person and it turns out he was deceived. It turns out the truth of Esav came out. All this stuff happens at once. And we know that Esav wants to kill Yaakov and the entire future of the Jewish, if there's going to be a Jewish nation, right now is a time for Yitzchak to be in the scene. But he's frozen. He's catatonic. He can't, respond. What does Rivka do? So it's one of the most oddest sequences in the end of Parsha told us. Rivka mentions to Yitzchak, by the way, let's talk about, imagine the scene here. Esav is going to kill Yaakov, okay? There's been a tremendous, the entire parenting of Yitzchak has gone out the window. And what does Rivka talk to Yitzchak about? By the way, Yitzchak, you should know that it's important that Yaakov know the right girl to marry. What is that doing at the end of the story, at the end of told us? The reason is that she realizes she has to get Yitzchak back into the scene. So by bringing up the future marriage of Yaakov, she realizes that while Yitzchak may have seen himself as failing as a parent, okay, he did realize, though, that he is still the leader of this fledgling Jewish nation, and therefore she brought him back into being the leader he's supposed to be. I think in many ways, Esther wanted that from Ahasuerus also. She pushed him, she nudged him, she manipulated him to become that independent person. And where did he express that independence? In saving the Jews. So what happens? What's the plan? The king has to come up with a plan on his own, right? It could not be through the influence of Esther. Ahasuerus could never believe it was Esther who was pushing the buttons. So that's why Esther presents to Ahasuerus the very plan he could never do, which is to reverse his edict. He could never do that. So what Ahasuerus could say is, it's not me. It's not Esther telling me. It's me working it out. And the second thing is that it could not be out of guilt. Ahasuerus could not be doing, let's say Ahasuerus did violate the prime directive of every king, which is never to reverse edict. We know what ended up happening. He'd resent her over time. We all know when you make decisions based on guilt, it often leads to resentment. So what does he do? He calls in both Mordechai, his advisor, and Esther. Now remember, Mordechai is the advisor now, and now he does what he's never done before. He tells them what he's going to do. First, he recalls the dilemma he's facing, right? That he named Esau, the Sati Les there, right? And now he comes up with his own idea. It's his own idea that's critical for the story to be successful here. So now he feels like it's his own idea. It's politically astute. And now that helps resolve the conflict, okay? But in this case, it seems like, right? And again, you got to be careful here. Doesn't mean that Esther wasn't being genuine in the tears she had for the sake of the Jewish people. However, it does seem that she's using that trait she was so good at, which is manipulation. That she really was able to, in a much more subtle way here, push certain buttons in Ahasuerus to finally get him to become that independent planner he was supposed to be. So that leaves us with an interesting question, which is, how do we look at Esther as a role model, right? To me, it's a fascinating question. Throughout the Megillah, we do see her over and over again acting in a very deceitful way, right? And it's interesting when you look at, if you look at, for instance, in Hilchos Deos, right, when the Rambam talks about, or Pirkei Avos, but so in Hilchos Deos, when the Rambam talks about the positive traits a person is supposed to have, or in Mesillas Yesharim, you don't see like being manipulating and deceiving as being high up in the list. If anything, they're really things that we're supposed to have disdain for. The idea of manipulating another person is a very dangerous thing to do. I mean, the haughtiness it produces is a very, very troubling thing. So yes, on the one hand, it's incredible to see that Esther used these traits of deception and manipulation for the good. But it is very interesting that Esther does not, in my opinion, and I don't think there's anyone who would disagree with this, she doesn't fit the classic pious tzedekes, Rebbetzin and so-and-so of, married to the Gadol Hador type of figure. That wasn't Esther. Esther was, in my opinion, much more of a realistic role model, which is somebody who understood, was she studying Gemara? Was she this great? We don't know anything about those aspects of her. What we do know is that she was courageous. She took the Jewish people on her shoulders, but it was really using through what we normally would say is a negative trait. And again, she diverted towards the better good, but still, it's amazing how much positive we attach to the fact that she was actually someone who was able to be successful at deceiving and at manipulating. So it's something to think about when we look at Esther, and I don't mean it in any negative way. It's just amazing that when you look at the paradigmatic values of the Megillah, to me, this is one of the ones that really stands out. The ability of somebody to be able to really tinker and play around with someone else's personality to the point of achieving the positive end of saving the Jewish people. Okay, I hope everyone enjoyed the shiur. Once again, Diana, thank you very much for the opportunity to share these ideas. And I hope everyone has a Freilich HaPurim.
Joshua.
Thank you.
Thank you. Joshua.